This is Kurt Benrud for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to our program. We're reading from And Then There Were None, a novel by Agatha Christie. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. We're pleased to present these dramatic readings of And Then There Were None using a cast of volunteer readers. Listen to Triangle Radio Reading Service for announcements about program times, or check our website at TriangleReadingService.org to view our complete schedule, or call us at 919-832-5138 with any comments or questions. Once again, that number is 832-5138. Welcome to our second hour. The first hour ended early in Chapter 3. In the first two chapters, we learned that 8 people have been invited as guests to Indian Island off the coast of Devon, England. We meet the butler and the cook who are there to take care of them, Mr. and Mrs. Rogers, and we also meet the man who brings them across on the boat, a fellow named Mr. Narracott. The hosts who have invited these people to the island are named Owen, and we meet all 8 of the guests. Mr. Justice Wargrave is a retired judge. Vera Claythorne is an ex-governess who is now secretary to Mrs. Owen. Captain Philip Lombard is a soldier of fortune. Emily Brent is a 65-year-old spinster. General MacArthur is a retired military man. He was in World War I. Dr. Armstrong is a physician. Anthony Marston is a young man, probably best described as a bit brash. There's a fellow who identifies himself as Mr. Davis. We, however, are aware that his name is Mr. Blore. Prominently displayed above the fireplace is the old nursery rhyme called 10 Little Indians. It's about 10 little Indian boys who die off one by one. It begins, 10 little Indian boys went out to dine. One choked his little self, and then there were 9. 9 little Indian boys sat up very late. One overslept himself, and then there were 8. The guests also notice that there are glass figurines of the 10 little Indians. They sit down to a wonderful dinner. After dinner, everyone is quite pleased with themselves and with life in general. Here is where we pick up our story. The whole party had dined well. They were satisfied with themselves and with life. The hands of the clock pointed to 9:20. There was a silence, a comfortable, replete silence. Into that silence came the voice, without warning, inhuman, penetrating. "Ladies and gentlemen, silence, please!" Everyone was startled. They looked round, at each other, at the walls. Who was speaking? The voice went on, a high, clear tone. "You are charged with the following indictments, Edward George Armstrong, that you did, upon the 14th day of March, 1925, cause the death of Louisa Mary Cleese, Emily Caroline Brent, that upon the 5th November, 1931, you were responsible for the death of Beatrice Taylor, William Henry Blore, that you brought about the death of James Stephen Landor on October 10th, 1928. Vera Elizabeth Claythorne, that on the 11th day of August, 1935, you killed Cyril Ogilvie Hamilton. Philip Lombard, that upon a date in February, 1932, you were guilty of the death of 21 men, members of an East African tribe. John Gordon MacArthur, that on the 4th of January, 1917, you deliberately sent your wife's lover, Arthur Richmond, to his death. Anthony James Marston, that upon the 14th day of November last, you were guilty of the murder of John and Lucy Combs. Thomas Rogers and Ethel Rogers, that on the 6th of May, 1929, you brought about the death of Jennifer Brady. Lawrence John Wargrave, that upon the 10th day of June, 1930, you were guilty of the murder of Edward Seaton. Prisoners at the bar, have you anything to say in your defense?" Chapter 3, Part 2. The voice had stopped. There was a moment's petrified silence, and then a resounding crash. Rogers had dropped the coffee tray. At the same moment, from somewhere outside the room, there came a scream and the sound of a thud. Lombard was the first to move. He leapt to the door and flung it open. Outside, lying in a huddled mass, was Mrs. Rogers. Lombard called, "Marston!" Anthony sprang to help him. Between them, they lifted up the woman and carried her into the drawing room. Dr. Armstrong came across quickly. He helped them to lift her onto the sofa and bent over her. He said quickly, "It's nothing. She's fainted, that's all. She'll be round in a moment." Lombard said to Rogers, "Get some brandy." Rogers, his face white, his hands shaking, murmured, "Yes, sir," and slipped quickly out of the room. Vera cried out, "Who was that speaking? Where was he? It sounded... General MacArthur spluttered out, "What's going on here? What kind of practical joke was that?" His hand was shaking. His shoulders sagged. He looked suddenly 10 years older. Blore was mopping his face with a handkerchief. Only Justice Wargrave and Miss Brent seemed comparatively unmoved. Emily Brent sat upright, her head held high. In both cheeks was a spot of hard color. The judge sat in his habitual pose, his head sunk down into his neck. With one hand he gently scratched his ear. Only his eyes were active, darting round and round the room, puzzled, alert with intelligence. Again it was Lombard who acted. Armstrong being busy with the collapsed woman, Lombard was free once more to take the initiative. He said, "That voice! It sounded as though it were in the room!" Vera cried, "Who was it? Who was it? It wasn't one of us!" Like the judge, Lombard's eyes wandered slowly round the room. They rested a moment on the open window. Then he shook his head decisively. Suddenly his eyes lighted up. He moved forward swiftly to where a door near the fireplace led into an adjoining room. With a swift gesture, he caught the handle and flung the door open. He passed through and immediately uttered an exclamation of satisfaction. He said, "Ah, here we are!" The others crowded after him. Only Miss Brent remained alone, sitting erect in her chair. Inside the second room, a table had been brought up close to the wall which adjoined the drawing room. On the table was a gramophone, an old-fashioned type, with a large trumpet attached. The mouth of the trumpet was against the wall, and Lombard, pushing it aside, indicated there were two or three small holes which had unobtrusively been bored through the wall. Adjusting the gramophone, he replaced the needle on the record, and immediately they heard again, "You are charged with the following indictments!" Vera cried, "Turn it off! Turn it off! It's horrible!" Lombard obeyed. Dr. Armstrong said, with a sigh of relief, "A disgraceful and heartless practical joke, I suppose." The small, clear voice of Mr. Justice Wargrave murmured, "So you think it's a joke, do you?" The doctor stared at him. "What else could it be?" The hand of the judge gently stroked his upper lip. He said, "At the moment I'm not prepared to give an opinion." Anthony Marston broke in. He said, "Look here, there's one thing you've forgotten. Who the devil turned the thing on and set it going?" Wargrave murmured, "Yes, I think we must inquire into that." He led the way back into the drawing room. The others followed. Rogers had just come in with a glass of brandy. Miss Brent was bending over the moaning form of Mrs. Rogers. Adroitly, Rogers slipped between the two women. "Allow me, madam, I'll speak to her. Ethel, Ethel, it's all right, all right, do you hear? Pull yourself together." Mrs. Rogers' breath came in quick gasps. Her eyes, staring, frightened eyes, went round and round the ring of faces. There was an urgency in Rogers' tone. "Pull yourself together, Ethel." Dr. Armstrong spoke to her soothingly. "You'll be all right now, Mrs. Rogers. Just a nasty turn." She said, "Did I faint, sir?" "Yes." "It was the voice, that awful voice, like a judgment." Her face turned green again. Her eyelids fluttered. Dr. Armstrong said sharply, "Where's that brandy?" Rogers had put it down on a little table. Someone handed it to the doctor, and he bent over the gasping woman with it. "Drink this, Mrs. Rogers." She drank, choking a little and gasping. The spirit did her good. The color returned to her face. She said, "I'm all right now. It just gave me a turn." Rogers said quickly, "Of course it did. It gave me a turn, too. Fair made me drop that tray. Wicked lies it was. I'd like to know—" He was interrupted. It was only a cough, a dry little cough, but it had the effect of stopping him in full cry. He stared at Mr. Justice Wargrave, and the latter coughed again. Then he said, "Who put that record on the gramophone? Was it you, Rogers?" Rogers cried, "I didn't know what it was, before God. I didn't know what it was, sir. If I had, I'd never have done it." The judge said dryly, "That is probably true, but I think you'd better explain, Rogers." The butler wiped his face with a handkerchief. He said earnestly, "I was just obeying orders, sir, that's all." "What orders?" "Mr. Owens." Mr. Justice Wargrave said, "Let me get this quite clear. Mr. Owens' orders were what exactly?" Rogers said, "I was to put the record on the gramophone. I'd find the record in the drawer, and my wife was to start the gramophone when I'd gone to the drawing-room with the coffee tray." The judge murmured, "A very remarkable story." Rogers cried, "It's the truth, sir. I swear to God it's the truth. I didn't know what it was, not for a moment. It had a name on it. I thought it was just a piece of music." Wargrave looked at Lombard. "Was there a title on it?" Lombard nodded. He grinned slowly, showing his white pointed teeth. He said, "Quite right, sir. It's entitled Swan Song." Chapter 3, Part 3. General MacArthur broke out suddenly. He exclaimed, "The whole thing is preposterous, preposterous. Slinging accusations about like this. Something must be done about it. This fellow Owen, whoever he is—" Emily Brent interrupted. She said sharply, "That's just it. Who is he?" The judge interposed. He spoke with the authority that a lifetime in the courts had given him. "That is exactly what we must go into very carefully. I should suggest that you get your wife to bed, first of all, Rogers, then come back here." "Yes, sir," Dr. Armstrong said. "I'll give you a hand, Rogers." Leaning on the two men, Mrs. Rogers tottered out of the room. When they had gone, Tony Marston said, "Don't know about you, sir, but I could do with a drink." Lombard said, "I agree." Tony said, "I'll go and forage." He went out of the room. He returned a second or two later. "Found them all waiting on a tray outside, ready to be brought in." He set down his burden carefully. The next minute or two was spent in dispensing drinks. General MacArthur had a stiff whiskey, and so did the judge. Everyone felt the need of a stimulant. Only Emily Brent demanded and obtained a glass of water. Dr. Armstrong re-entered the room. "She's all right," he said. "I've given her a sedative to take. What's that, a drink? I could do with one." Several of the men refilled their glasses. A moment or two later, Rogers re-entered the room. Mr. Justice Wargrave took charge of the proceedings. The room became an impromptu court of law. The judge said, "Now then, Rogers, we must get to the bottom of this. Who is this Mr. Owen?" Rogers stared. "He owns the place, sir." "I am aware of that fact. What I want you to tell me is what you yourself know about the man." Rogers shook his head. "Can't say, sir. You see, I've never seen him." There was a faint stir in the room. General MacArthur said, "You've never seen him? What do you mean?" "We've only just been here under a week, my wife and I, sir. We were engaged by letter through an agency, the Regina Agency in Plymouth." Bloor nodded. "Old established firm," he volunteered. Wargrave said, "Have you got that letter?" "The letter engaging us? No, sir, I didn't keep it." "Go on with your story. You were engaged, as you say, by letter." "Yes, sir. We were to arrive on a certain day. We did. Everything was in order here. Plenty of food in stock, and everything very nice. We just needed dusting, and that was it."
"What next?"
"Nothing, sir. We got orders, by letter again, to prepare the rooms for a house party. And then yesterday, by the afternoon post, I got another letter from Mr. Owen. It said he and Mrs. Owen were detained, and to do the best we could, and gave it the instructions about dinner and coffee and putting on the gramophone record."
The judge said sharply, "Surely you've got that letter?"
"Yes, sir, I've got it here."
He produced it from his pocket. The judge took it. "Hmm," he said. "Headed Ritz Hotel and typewritten." With a quick movement, Bloor was beside him. He said, "If you'll just let me have a look." He twitched it out of the other's hand and ran his eye over it. He murmured, "Coronation machine, quite new, no defects. Ensign paper, the most widely used make. You won't get anything out of that. Might be fingerprints, but I doubt it." Wargrave stared at him with sudden attention. Anthony Marston was standing beside Bloor, looking over his shoulder. He said, "Got some fancy Christian names, hasn't he? Ulick Norman Owen. Quite a mouthful."
The old judge said with a slight start, "I am obliged to you, Mr. Marston. You have drawn my attention to a curious and suggestive point." He looked round at the others, and thrusting his neck forward like an angry tortoise, he said, "I think the time has come for all of us to pool our information. It would be well, I think, for everyone to come forward with all the information they have regarding the owner of this house." He paused and then went on. "We are all his guests. I think it would be profitable if each one of us were to explain exactly how that came about."
There was a moment's pause, and then Emily Brent spoke with decision. "There's something very peculiar about all of this," she said. "I received a letter with a signature that was not very easy to read. It purported to be from a woman I had met at a certain summer resort 2 or 3 years ago. I took the name to be either Ogden or Oliver. I am acquainted with a Mrs. Oliver, and also with a Miss Ogden. I am quite certain that I have never met or become friendly with anyone of the name Owen."
Mr. Justice Wargrave said, "You have that letter, Miss Brent?"
"Yes, I will fetch it for you."
She went away and returned a minute later with the letter. The judge read it. He said, "I begin to understand. Miss Claythorne?" Vera explained the circumstances of her secretarial engagement. The judge said, "Marston?"
Anthony said, "Got a wire from a pal of mine, Badger Berkeley. Surprised me at the time because I had an idea the old horse had gone to Norway. Told me to roll up here."
Again Wargrave nodded, said, "Dr. Armstrong?"
"I was called in professionally."
"I see. You had no previous acquaintanceship with the family?"
"No. A colleague of mine was mentioned in the letter."
The judge said, "To give verisimilitude, yes, and that colleague, I presume, was momentarily out of touch with you."
"Well, yes."
Lombard, who had been staring at Bloor, said suddenly,
"Look here. I've just thought of something."
The judge lifted a hand.
"In a minute. But I..."
"We will take one thing at a time, Mr. Lombard. We are at present inquiring into the causes which have resulted in our being assembled here tonight. General MacArthur..."
Pulling at his mustache, the general muttered,
"Got a letter from this fellow Owen. Mentioned some old pals of mine who were to be here. Hoped I'd excuse informal invitation. Haven't kept the letter, I'm afraid." Wargrave said, "Mr. Lombard..."
Lombard's brain had been active. Was he to come out in the open or not? He made up his mind.
"Same sort of thing," he said. "Invitation, mention of mutual friends. I fell for it, all right. I've torn up the letter."
Mr. Justice Wargrave turned his attention to Mr. Bloor. His forefinger stroked his upper lip, and his voice was dangerously polite. He said,
"Just now we had a somewhat disturbing experience. An apparently disembodied voice spoke to us all by name, uttering certain precise accusations against us. We will deal with those accusations presently. At the moment I am interested in a minor point. Amongst the names recited was that of William Henry Bloor. But as far as I know, there is no one named Bloor among us. The name of Davis was not mentioned. What do you have to say about that, Mr. Davis?"
Bloor said sulkily, "Cat's out of the bag, it seems. I suppose I'd better admit that my name isn't Davis."
"You are William Henry Bloor?"
"That's right."
"I will add something," said Lombard. "Not only are you here under a false name, Mr. Bloor, but in addition I've noticed this evening that you're a first-class liar. You claim to have come from Natal, South Africa. I know South Africa and Natal, and I'm prepared to swear that you've never set foot in South Africa in your life."
All eyes were turned on Bloor. Angry, suspicious eyes. Anthony Marston moved a step nearer to him. His fists clenched themselves.
"Now then, you swine!" he said. "Any explanation?"
Bloor flung back his head and set his square jaw. "You gentlemen have got me wrong," he said. "I've got my credentials, and you can see them. I am an ex-CID man. I run a detective agency in Plymouth. I was put on this job."
Mr. Justice Wargrave asked, "By whom?"
"This man, Owen, enclosed a handsome money order for expenses and instructed me as to what he wanted done. I was to join the house party, posing as a guest. I was given all your names. I was to watch you all."
"Any reason given?"
Bloor said bitterly. Mrs. Owen's jewels. Mrs. Owen, my foot, I don't believe there's any such person." Again the forefinger of the judge stroked his lip, this time appreciatively. "Your conclusions are, I think, justified," he said. "Ulick Norman Owen. In Miss Brent's letter, though the signature of the surname is a mere scrawl, the Christian names are reasonably clear. Una Nancy. In either case, you notice the same initials. Ulick Norman Owen, Una Nancy Owen, each time. That is to say, U. N. Owen, all by a slight stretch of fancy, unknown." Vera cried, "But this is fantastic! Mad!" The judge nodded. He said, "Oh, yes. I've no doubt in my own mind that we've been invited here by a madman, probably a dangerous, homicidal lunatic."
Chapter 4. There was a moment's silence, a silence of dismay and bewilderment. Then the judge's small, clear voice took up the thread once more. "We will now proceed to the next stage of our inquiry. First, however, I will add my own credentials to the list." He took a letter from his pocket and tossed it onto the table. "This purports to be from an old friend of mine, Lady Constance Comington. I have not seen her for some years. She went to the East. It is exactly the kind of vague, incoherent letter she would write, urging me to join her here, and referring to her host and hostess in only the vaguest terms. The same technique you will observe. I only mention it because it agrees with the other evidence. From all which emerges one interesting point. Whoever it was who enticed us here, that person knows, or has taken the trouble to find out, a good deal about us all. He, whoever he may be, is aware of my friendship for Lady Constance, and is familiar with her epistolary style. He knows something about Dr. Armstrong's colleagues and their present whereabouts. He knows the nickname of Mr. Marston's friend, and the kind of telegrams he sends. He knows exactly where Miss Brent was 2 years ago for her holiday, and the kind of people she met there. He knows all about General MacArthur's old cronies." He paused, and then said, "He knows, you see, a good deal, and out of his knowledge concerning us, he has made certain definite accusations." Immediately a babble broke out. General MacArthur shouted, "A pack of damn lies! Slander!" Vera cried out, "It's iniquitous!" Her breath came fast. "Wicked!" Rogers said hoarsely, "A lie! A wicked lie! We never did! Neither of us!" Anthony Marston growled, "Don't know what that damn fool was getting at!" The upraised hand of Mr. Justice Wargrave calmed the tumult. He said, picking his words with care, "I wish to say this. Our unknown friend accuses me of the murder of one Edward Seaton. I remember Seaton perfectly well. He came up before me for trial in June of the year 1930. He was charged with the murder of an elderly woman. He was very ably defended, and made a good impression on the jury in the witness box. Nevertheless, on the evidence, he was certainly guilty. I summed up accordingly, and the jury brought in a verdict of guilty. In passing sentence of death, I concurred with the verdict. An appeal was lodged on the grounds of misdirection. The appeal was rejected, and the man was duly executed. I wish to say before you all that my conscience is perfectly clear on the matter. I did my duty and no more. I passed sentence on a rightly convicted murderer." Armstrong was remembering now. The Seaton case. The verdict had come as a great surprise. He had met Matthew, K.C., on one of the days of the trial, dining at a restaurant. Matthews had been confident. Not a doubt of the verdict. Acquittal practically certain. And then afterwards he had heard comments. Judge was Stetson against him. Turned the jury right round and they brought him in guilty. Quite legal, though. Old Wargrave knows his law. It was almost as though he had a private down on the fellow. All these memories rushed through the doctor's mind. Before he could consider the wisdom of the question, he asked impulsively, "Did you know Seton at all? I mean, previous to the case?" The hooded reptilian eyes met his. In a clear, cold voice, the judge said, "I knew nothing of Seton previous to the case." Armstrong said to himself, "The fellow's lying. I know he's lying." Chapter 4, Part 2. Vera Claythorne spoke in a trembling voice. She said, I'd like to tell you about the child, Cyril Hamilton. I was nursery governess to him. He was forbidden to swim out far. One day, when my attention was distracted, he started off. I swam after him. I couldn't get there in time. It was awful, but it wasn't my fault. At the inquest, the coroner exonerated me, and his mother, she was so kind. If even she didn't blame me, why should this awful thing be said? It's not fair, it's not fair." She broke down, weeping bitterly. General MacArthur patted her shoulder. He said, "There, there, my dear. Of course it's not true. Fellow's a madman. A madman. Got a bee in his bonnet. Got hold of the wrong end of the stick all round." He stood erect, squaring his shoulders. He barked out, "Best really to leave this sort of thing unanswered. However, feel I ought to say, no truth. No truth whatsoever in what he said about, young Arthur Richmond. Richmond was one of my officers. I sent him on a reconnaissance. He was killed. Natural course of events in wartime. Wish to say, resent very much slur on my wife. Best woman in the world. Absolutely. Caesar's wife." General MacArthur sat down. His shaking hand pulled at his mustache. The effort to speak had cost him a great deal. Lombard spoke. His eyes were amused. He said, "About those natives." Marston said, "What about them?" Philip Lombard grinned. "Story's quite true. I left 'em. Matter of self-preservation. We were lost in the bush. I and a couple of other fellows took what food there was and cleared out." General MacArthur said sternly, "You abandoned your men? Left them to starve?" Lombard said, "Not quite the act of the Pooka Sahib, I'm afraid. But self-preservation's a man-first duty. And natives don't mind dying, you know. They don't feel about it as Europeans do." Vera lifted her face from her hands. She said, staring at him, You left them to die?" Lombard answered, "I left them to die." His amused eyes looked into her horrified ones. Anthony Marston said, in a slow, puzzled voice, "I've just been thinking. John and Lucy Combs. Must have been a couple of kids I ran over near Cambridge. Beastly bad luck." Mr. Justice Wargrave said acidly, "For them or for you?" Anthony said, "Well, I was thinking for me, of course. You're right, sir. It was damned bad luck on them. Of course, it was pure accident. They rushed out of some cottage or other. I had my license endorsed for a year. Beastly nuisance." Dr. Armstrong said warmly, "This speeding, all wrong, all wrong. Young men like you are a danger to the community." Anthony shrugged his shoulders. He said, "Speed's come to stay. English roads are hopeless, of course. Can't get up a decent pace on them." He looked round vaguely for his glass, picked it up off a table, and went to the side table and helped himself to another whiskey and soda. He said over his shoulder, "Well, anyway, it wasn't my fault. Just an accident." Chapter 4, Part 3. The manservant Rogers had been moistening his lips and twisting his hands. He said now in a low, deferential voice, "If I might just say a word, sir," Lombard said. "Go ahead, Rogers." Rogers cleared his throat and passed his tongue once more over his dry lips. "There was a mention, sir, of me and Mrs. Rogers, and of Miss Brady. There isn't a word of truth in it, sir. My wife and I were with Miss Brady till she died. She was always in poor health, sir, always, from the time we came to her. There was a storm, sir, that night, the night she was taken bad. The telephone was out of order. We couldn't get the doctor to her. I went for him, sir, on foot, but he got there too late. We'd done everything possible for her, sir. Devoted to her we were. Anyone would tell you the same. There was never a word said against us. Not a word." Lombard looked thoughtfully at the man's twitching face, his dry lips, the fright in his eye. He remembered the crash of the falling coffee tray. He thought, but did not say, "Oh, yeah." Bloor spoke in his hearty, bullying official manner. He said, "Came into a little something at her death, though, eh?" Rogers drew himself up. He said stiffly, "Miss Brady left us a legacy in recognition of our faithful services. And why not, I would like to know?" Lombard said, "What about yourself, Mr. Bloor?"
"What about me?"
"Your name was included in the list." Bloor went purple.
"Landor, you mean. That was the bank robbery. London and Commercial."
Mr. Justice Wargrave stirred. He said, "I remember. It didn't come before me, but I remember the case. Landor was convicted on your evidence. You were the police officer in charge of the case?" Bloor said,
"I was. Landor got penal servitude for life and died in Dartmoor a year later. He was a delicate man."
Bloor said,
"He was a crook. It was he who knocked out the night watchman. The case was quite clear against him."
Wargrave said slowly,
"You were complimented, I think, on your handling of the case."
Bloor said sulkily,
"I got my promotion," he added in a thick voice. "I was only doing my duty."
Lombard laughed, a sudden ringing laugh. He said,
"What a duty-loving, law-abiding lot we all seem to be, myself excepted. What about you, Doctor, and your little professional mistake? Illegal operation, was it?"
Emily Brent glanced at him in sharp distaste and drew herself away a little. Dr. Armstrong, very much master of himself, shook his head good-naturedly.
"I'm at a loss to understand the matter," he said. "The name meant nothing to me when it was spoken. Was it, what, Cleese? Close? I really can't remember having a patient of that name, or being connected with a death in any way. The thing's a complete mystery to me. Of course, it's a long time ago. It might possibly be one of my operation cases in the hospital. They come too late, so many of these people. But when the patient dies, they always consider it the surgeon's fault." He sighed, shaking his head. He thought, "Drunk. That's what it was. Drunk. And I operated. Nerves all to pieces. Hands shaking. I killed her all right. Poor devil. Elderly woman. Simple job if I'd been sober. Lucky for me there's loyalty in our profession. The sister knew, of course, but she held her tongue. God, it gave me a shock, pulled me up. But who could have known about it after all these years?
Chapter 4, Part 4. There was a silence in the room. Everybody was looking, covertly or openly, at Emily Brett. It was a minute or two before she became aware of the expectation. Her eyebrows rose on her narrow forehead. She said,
"Are you waiting for me to say something? I have nothing to say."
The judge said,
"Nothing, Miss Brent."
"Nothing." Her lips closed tightly. The judge stroked his face. He said mildly, "You reserve your defense." Miss Brent said coldly,
"There is no question of defense. I have always acted in accordance with the dictates of my conscience. I have nothing with which to reproach myself."
There was an unsatisfied feeling in the air, but Emily Brent was not one to be swayed by public opinion. She sat unyielding. The judge cleared his throat once or twice. Then he said,
"Our inquiry rests there. Now, Rogers, who else is there on this island besides ourself and you and your wife?"
"Nobody, sir. Nobody at all."
"You're sure of that?"
"Quite sure, sir."
Wargrave said,
"I am not yet clear as to the purpose of our unknown host in getting us to assemble here, but in my opinion this person, whoever he may be, is not sane in the accepted sense of the word. He may be dangerous, and in my opinion it would be well for us to leave this place as soon as possible. I suggest we leave tonight."
Rogers said, "I beg your pardon, sir, but there's no boat on the island."
"No boat at all?"
"No, sir."
"How do you communicate with the mainland?"
"Fred Narracourt. He comes over every morning, sir. He brings the bread and the milk and the post and takes orders."
Mr. Justice Wargrave said,
"Then in my opinion, it would be well if we all left tomorrow morning as soon as Narracourt's boat arrives."
There was a chorus of agreement, with only one dissentient voice. It was Anthony Marston, who disagreed with the majority.
"A bit unsporting, what?" he said. "Ought to ferret out the mystery before we go. Whole thing's like a detective story. Positively thrilling."
The judge said acidly,
"At my time of life, I have no desire for thrills, as you call them."
Anthony said with a grin,
"The legal life's narrowing. I'm all for crime. Here's to it."
He picked up his drink and drank it off in a gulp. Too quickly, perhaps. He choked. Choked badly. His face contorted, turned purple. He gasped for breath, then slid down off his chair, the glass falling from his hand.
Chapter 5. It was so sudden and so unexpected that it took everyone's breath away. They remained stupidly staring at the crumpled figure on the ground. Then Dr. Armstrong jumped up and went over to him, kneeling beside him. When he raised his head, his eyes were bewildered. He said in a low, awestruck whisper, "My God, he's dead." They didn't take it in, not at once. Dead? Dead? That young Norse god in the prime of his health and strength, struck down all in a moment? Healthy young men don't die like that, choking over a whiskey and soda. No, they couldn't take it in. Dr. Armstrong was peering into the dead man's face. He sniffed at the blue, twisted lips. Then he picked up the glass from which Anthony Marston had been drinking. General MacArthur said,
"Dead? Do you mean the fellow just choked and died?"
The physician said, "You can call it choking if you like. He died of asphyxiation, right enough." He was sniffing now at the glass. He dipped a finger into the dregs and very cautiously just touched the finger with the tip of his tongue.
His expression altered. General MacArthur said,
"Never knew a man could die like that, just of a choking fit."
Emily Brent said in a clear voice, "In the midst of life we are in death." Dr. Armstrong stood up. He said brusquely, "No, a man doesn't die of a mere choking fit. Marston's death wasn't what we call a natural death." Vera said almost in a whisper, "Was there something in the whiskey?" Armstrong nodded. "Yes, can't say exactly. Everything points at one of the cyanides. No distinctive smell of prussic acid. Probably potassium cyanide. It acts pretty well instantaneously." The judge said sharply, "It was in his glass?" "Yes." The doctor strode to the table where the drinks were. He removed the stopper from the whiskey and smelt it and tasted it. Then he tasted the soda water. He shook his head. "They're both all right," Lombard said. "You mean he must have put the stuff in the glass himself?" Armstrong nodded with a curiously dissatisfied expression. He said, "Seems like it." Bloor said, "Suicide, eh? That's a queer go." Vera said slowly, "You never think that he would kill himself. He was so alive. He was, oh, enjoying himself. When he came down the hill on his car this evening, I can't explain it." But they knew what she meant. Anthony Marston, in the height of his youth and manhood, had seemed like a being who was immortal, and now, crumpled and broken, he lay on the floor. Dr. Armstrong said, "Is there any possibility other than suicide?" Slowly everyone shook his head. There could be no other explanation. The drinks themselves were untampered with. They had all seen Anthony Marston go across and help himself. It followed, therefore, that any cyanide in the drink must have been put there by Anthony Marston himself. And yet, why should Anthony Marston commit suicide? Bloor said thoughtfully, "You know, Doctor, it doesn't seem right to me. I shouldn't have said Mr. Marston was a suicidal type of gentleman." Armstrong answered, "I agree." Chapter 5, Part 2. They had left it like that. What else was there to say? Together, Armstrong and Lombard had carried the inert body of Anthony Marston to his bedroom and had laid him there covered only with a sheet. When they came downstairs again, the others were standing in a group, shivering a little, though the night was not cold. Emily Brent said, "We'd better go to bed. It's late." It was past 12 o'clock. The suggestion was a wise one, yet everyone hesitated. It was as though they clung to each other's company for reassurance. The judge said, "Yes, we must get some sleep." Rogers said, "I haven't cleared yet in the dining room." Lombard said curtly, "Do it in the morning." Armstrong said to him, "Is your wife all right?" "I'll go and see." He returned a minute or two later. "Sleeping beautiful, she is." "Good," said the doctor. "Don't disturb her." "No, sir, I'll just put things straight in the dining room and make sure everything's locked up right. Then I'll turn in." He went across the hall into the dining room. The others went upstairs, a slow, unwilling procession. If this had been an old house with creaking wood and dark shadows and heavily paneled walls, there might have been an eerie feeling. But this house was the essence of modernity. There were no dark corners, no possible sliding panels. It was flooded with electric light. Everything was new and bright and shining. There was nothing hidden in this house, nothing concealed. It had no atmosphere about it. Somehow, that was the most frightening thing of all. They exchanged good nights on the upper landing. Each of them went to his or her own room, and each of them automatically, almost without conscious thought, locked the door. Chapter 5, Part 3. In his pleasant, softly tinted room, Mr. Justice Wargrave removed his garments and prepared himself for bed. He was thinking about Edward Seton. He remembered Seton very well, his fair hair, his blue eyes, his habit of looking you straight in the face with a pleasant air of straightforwardness. That was what had made so good an impression on the jury. Llewellyn, for the Crown, had bungled it a bit. He had been over-vehement. He had tried to prove too much. Matthews, on the other hand, for the defense, had been good. His points had told. His cross-examinations had been deadly. His handling of his client on the witness box had been masterly. And Seaton had come through the ordeal of cross-examination well. He had not got excited or over-vehement. The jury had been impressed. It had seemed to Matthews, perhaps, as though everything had been over the bar shouting. The judge wound up his watch carefully and placed it in the bed. He remembered exactly how he had felt sitting there, listening, making notes, appreciating everything, tabulating every scrap of evidence that told against the prisoner. He'd enjoyed that case. Matthews' final speech had been first class. Llewellyn, coming after it, had failed to remove the good impression that the defending counsel had made. And then had come his own summing up. Carefully, Mr. Justice Wargrave removed his false teeth and dropped them into a glass of water. The shrunken lips fell in. It was a cruel mouth now, cruel and predatory. Hooding his eyes, the judge smiled to himself. He'd cooked Seaton's goose, all right. With a slightly rheumatic grunt, he climbed into bed and turned out the electric light. Chapter 5, Part 4. Downstairs in the dining room, Rogers stood puzzled. He was staring at the china figures in the center of the table. He muttered to himself, "That's a rum go. I could have sworn there were 10 of them." Chapter 5, Part 5. General MacArthur tossed from side to side. Sleep would not come to him. In the darkness, he kept seeing Arthur Richmond's face. He'd liked Arthur. He'd been damned fond of Arthur. He'd been pleased that Leslie liked him, too. Leslie was so capricious. Lots of good fellows that Leslie would turn up her nose at and pronounce dull. Dull, just like that. But she hadn't found Arthur Richmond dull. They'd got on well together from the beginning. They'd talked of plays and music and pictures together. She'd teased him, made fun of him, ragged him. And he, MacArthur, had been delighted at the thought that Leslie took quite a motherly interest in the boy. Motherly, indeed. Damn fool not to remember that Richmond was 28 to Leslie's 29. He'd love Leslie. He could see her now, her heart-shaped face and her dancing deep gray eyes and the brown curling moss of her hair. He'd loved Leslie, and he'd believed in her absolutely. Out there in France, in the middle of all the hell of it, he'd sat thinking of her, taking her picture out of the breast pocket of his tunic. And then he'd found out. It had come exactly in the way things happened in books. The letter in the wrong envelope. She'd been writing to them both, and she'd put her letter to Richmond in the envelope addressed to her husband. Even now, all these years later, he could feel the shock of it. The pain. God, it had hurt. And the business had been going on some time. The letter made that clear. Weekends. Richmond's last leave. Leslie. Leslie and Arthur. God damn that fellow. Damn his smiling face. His brisk, "Yes, sir!" Liar and hypocrite. Stealer of another man's wife. It had gathered slowly, that cold, murderous rage. He'd managed to carry on as usual, to show nothing. He'd tried to make his manner to Richmond just the same. Had he succeeded? He thought so. Richmond hadn't suspected. Inequalities of temper were easily accounted for there, where men's nerves were continually snapping under the strain. Only young Armitage had looked at him curiously once or twice. Quite a young chap, but he'd had perceptions, that boy. Armitage, perhaps, had guessed when the time came. He'd sent Richmond deliberately to death. Only a miracle could have brought him through unhurt. That miracle didn't happen. Yes, he'd sent Richmond to his death, and he wasn't sorry. It had been easy enough. Mistakes were being made all the time. Officers being sent to death needlessly. All was confusion, panic. People might say afterwards, "Old MacArthur lost his nerve a bit, made some colossal blunders, sacrificed some of his best men." But they couldn't say more. Young Armitage was different. He'd looked at his commanding officer very oddly. He'd known, perhaps, that Richmond was being deliberately sent to his death. After the war was over, had Armitage talked? Leslie hadn't known. Leslie had wept for her lover, he supposed, but her weeping was over by the time he'd come back to England. He'd never told her that he'd found out. They'd gone on together. Only somehow, she hadn't seemed very real anymore. And then 3 or 4 years later, she got double pneumonia and died. That had been a long time ago. 15 years? 16 years? And he'd left the army and come to live in Devon. Bought the sort of little place he'd always meant to have. Nice neighbors, pleasant part of the world. There was a nice bit of shooting and fishing. He'd gone to church on Sundays, but not the day that the lesson was read about David putting Uriah in the forefront of the battle. Somehow he couldn't face that. Gave him an uncomfortable feeling. Everybody had been very friendly. At first, that is. Later, he'd had an uneasy feeling that people were talking about him behind his back. They eyed him differently somehow, as though they'd heard something. Some lying rumor. Armitage? Supposing Armitage had talked. He'd avoided people after that, withdrawn into himself. Unpleasant to feel that people were discussing you. For all so long ago, so purposeless now, Leslie had faded into the distance, and Arthur Richmond, too. Nothing of what had happened seemed to matter any more. It made life lonely, though. He'd taken to shunning his old army friends. If Armitage had talked, they'd known about it. And now this evening, a hidden voice had blared out that old hidden story. Had he dealt with it all right? Kept a stiff upper lip? Betrayed the right amount of feeling? Indignation? Disgust? But no guilt, no discomfiture, nothing to tell. Surely nobody could have taken the accusation seriously. There had been a pack of other nonsense just as far-fetched. That charming girl, the voice had accused her of drowning a child. Idiotic. Some madman throwing crazy accusations about. Emily Brent, too. Actually, a niece of old Tom Brent of the regiment. It had accused her of murder. Anyone could see with half an eye that the woman was as pious as could be, the kind that was hand and glove with parsons. Damned curious business, the whole thing. Crazy, nothing less. Ever since they had got there. When was that? Why, damn it, it was only this afternoon. Seemed a good bit longer than that. He thought, I wonder when we shall get away again. Tomorrow, of course, when the motorboat came from the mainland. Funny. Just this minute, he didn't much want to get away from the island. To go back to the mainland. Back to this little house. Back to all the troubles and worries. Through the open window, he could hear the waves breaking on the rocks. A little louder now than earlier in the evening. Wind was up, too. He thought, peaceful sound. Peaceful place. He thought, best of an island is, once you get there, you can't go any further. You've come to the end of things. He knew suddenly that he didn't want to leave the island. Chapter 5, Part 6. Vera Claythorne lay in bed, wide awake, staring up at the ceiling. The light beside her was on. She was frightened of the dark. She was thinking, Hugo, Hugo, why do I feel you're so near to me tonight? Somewhere quite close. Where is he really? I don't know. I never shall know. He just went away. Right away. Out of my life. It was no good trying not to think of Hugo. He was close to her. She had to think of him, to remember. Cornwall. The black rocks. The smooth yellow sand. Mrs. Hamilton, stout, good-natured. Cyril, whining a little always, pulling at her hand. I want to swim out to the rock, Miss Claythorne. Why can't I swim out to the rock? Looking up, meeting Hugo's eyes watching her. The evenings after Cyril was in bed. Come out for a stroll, Miss Claythorne?
I think perhaps I will.
The decorous stroll down the beach. The moonlight, the soft Atlantic air, and then Hugo's arms round her. I love you. I love you. You know I love you, Vera. Yes, she knew, or thought she knew. I can't ask you to marry me. I haven't got a penny. It's all I can do to keep myself. Queer, you know. Once for 3 months I had the chance of being a rich man to look forward to. Cyril wasn't born until 3 months after Maurice died. If he'd been a girl. If the child had been a girl, Hugo would have come into everything. He'd been disappointed, he admitted. I hadn't built on it, of course, but it was a bit of a knock. Oh, well, luck's luck. Cyril's a nice lad. I'm awfully fond of him. And he was fond of him, too, always ready to play games or amuse his small nephew. No rancor in Hugo's nature. Cyril wasn't really strong. A puny child, no stamina. The kind of child, perhaps, who wouldn't live to grow up. And then, Miss Claythorne, why can't I swim to the rock? Irritating, whiny repetition. It's too far, Cyril. But Miss Claythorne! Vera got up. She went to the dressing table and swallowed 3 aspirins. She thought, I wish I had some proper sleeping stuff. She thought, if I were doing away with myself, I'd take an overdose of Veranor, something like that. Not cyanide. She shuddered as she remembered Anthony Marston's convulsed purple face. As she passed the mantelpiece, she looked up at the framed doggerel. 10 little Indian boys went out to dine. One choked his little self, and then there were 9. She thought to herself, it's horrible. Just like us this evening. Why had Anthony Marston wanted to die? She didn't want to die. She couldn't imagine wanting to die. Death was for the other people. We hope you've enjoyed the second hour of Agatha Christie's And Then There Were None. Be sure to check your schedule to find out when you can listen to the third hour, which begins with Chapter 6.